Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. High stakes. With the huge growth in gambling, especially online, we find out how the church is warning people about the addictive nature of this apparently harmless pastime. Cherish Life. We talk to the founder of the Cherish Life Circle in New York City that helps both the families of murder victims and the criminal. More and more people are gambling, largely due to the huge growth in online betting. But how high can the stakes really get? When does a game of roulette cease to be a harmless pastime and become a dangerous compulsion? Well, the answer is far more often than many people think. Figures suggest that a significant percentage of regular gamblers can gradually become addicted to gambling, and this in turn can lead to marriage breakups, domestic violence, child abuse, bankruptcy, and even suicide. I've been finding out more in this special report.
Make no mistake, gambling is an addiction. It can turn into an illness very quickly, and this is what the gambling companies play on.
John Farrelly is a counsellor at Accord, a Catholic marriage support service in Ireland. He has seen with his own eyes how more and more Irish families are coming under pressure due to gambling addictions. Despite the negative impact on families and individuals, the gambling industry is going from strength to strength. Figures show that the global revenue from gambling is growing by nearly 10% a year and is expected to top $100 billion in a couple of years' time. John says Ireland is no exception to this worldwide boom.
It is growing all the time. For example, I'm just thinking in terms of in Dublin at the moment, there's six casinos, which, you know, not too long ago there was no such thing as a casino. In terms of the online gambling, some of the most profitable companies in Ireland are makers who have now gone online. And I suppose the real hard thing about all this is it's hidden just below the surface. A lot of these companies are offshore companies, and so the profits don't necessarily come back through the Irish books. And so it's really hard to track how much is being spent. But just in terms of people coming to Accord, we know it's becoming an issue for marriage and family.
The Diocese of Calgary in Western Canada is thousands of kilometres away across the ocean from Ireland, but here too there is growing concern about the impact of compulsive gambling. Bishop Frederick Henry is the local bishop, and he has been at the forefront of efforts to speak out about the dangers of getting involved with gambling.
We're seeing more and more anecdotal evidence in particular of just the range of devastation of family life. People are losing their homes, they're losing their cars, they're losing their jobs. They get involved in all kind of nefarious activity in order to support a gambling habit. But as I say, I don't think we should just be looking at it from an individual pathology point of view, but we should be looking at it from a social or public health view. And it's this particular dimension that I think is new, and we're looking at this and starting to say now, what does this do to us as a society? Does the government, in order to avoid the unhealthy subject of taxation, resort to something that's regressive, that we know it doesn't depend upon personal income, but does tend to target those who are weak and vulnerable, frequently the poor and some of the seniors in our society?
John Farrelly explains how even a parent's concern for their children can be secondary to feeding their gambling addiction.
Well, let's put it this way. If you have children, they need to be fed and they need to have shoes on their feet at the very simplest level. When one's addicted to gambling, that can actually become secondary. The gambling can become the primary thing, the preoccupation with the gambling. And at its very worst level, it can mean that children, it can force children and family into poverty.
And roughly speaking, do we know what percentage of those who gamble do become addicted?
Well, this is the real problem with this area. How it came to us in Accord was we have training on a regular basis, and 5% of people coming to us have problems with addictions. However, we're beginning to notice, even before the stats are out, a number of our counsellors, we would have 300 counsellors, and those counsellors, it really is becoming a problem that they're talking about. And so what you probably find is that it's just below the radar, but it's going to become a problem for society, and particularly Irish society.
I gather that the incidence of online gambling is increasing incredibly fast. Is that the case in Ireland as well?
Yeah, very much so. I suppose the thing is, it's marketed in a way that it's your best friend and it's a bit of fun. The marketing executives and the people who purport this don't sit in the counselling rooms with us.
Just as gambling is increasing in leaps and bounds in many countries, so are the number of compulsive gamblers, who can become so desperate that sometimes they are driven to take their own lives. John again.
I give you an example of a man and a woman that we were seeing. They were surviving, but they had a mortgage out in their house for €500,000. When you talk to them and it unravels, then you hear about this years and years of taking out another mortgage, and there was no need to. So in about 5 or 6 years, they owed €400,000 to €500,000. And if that was to continue for another 5 years, you can just imagine how bad that family would be. They were really under pressure. It was really putting their marriage under pressure. But for all the world, there wasn't a problem, but there really, really was.
And do we have any ideas how many families are coming under pressure because one or both of the spouses has a gambling addiction?
It's very hard to put a figure on it, again, because of the stigma around it and also the way the companies market it. But recently, there was an example in Scotland, and the chap spent over €158,000 one night by maxing out 13 credit cards belonging to his parents, and eventually then committed suicide. The real thing here is that there's no structures and processes to control this. What you have is the ability of people who are purely after profit. Really need to keep this in mind. Have no regard for the people, the individuals or the children involved. And the only thing driving this is the pursuit of profit.
The problem, according to John, is that addiction to gambling is a slow and insidious process that can creep up on its victims unaware.
The thing with an addiction is it slowly, slowly, slowly gets worse, and eventually you end up really in the ha'penny place, for want of a better word. Really what you need to do with any form of addiction is first recognise that the addiction's there and bringing the real facts of the amount of money that is spent. And really with addiction, it very quickly imprints itself on the relationship if you can get both people to be honest about it.
You talked about the fact that gambling is an industry based on profit. Do you think, in fact, that in some ways gambling panders to the worst in human nature, both on the part of the gambler who is looking for riches and, of course, the industry that's looking for profits?
I think so. However, I do believe that society is about the structures and processes we put in place for our people, because human beings are vulnerable at different times in their life. And really it's about the leaders in that community, the government, the church, trying to set, you know, what do we believe in? Obviously there's a free will there for people. However, when you have structures in place in terms of entities and companies, there is no good for society there whatsoever. There has to be some way of looking at this and trying to elicit, you know, what's going on here. But I take your point about it does tap into this idea of the get-rich-quick scheme, the fantasy in terms of gambling and addiction.
Bishop Henry says whilst the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that gambling is not intrinsically wrong, he believes it is morally wrong for a Catholic institution to formally cooperate in an industry that is based on greed.
The Catechism of the Catholic Church very clearly and succinctly expresses Catholic teaching and says that games of chance, whether we're talking about card games or modest wagers, are not in themselves contrary to justice. But they become morally unacceptable when they deprive someone of something that is necessary for their needs or those of others. So there is always something deep inside of us that seems to kind of open up this passion for gambling to become really enslavement. And we know that there are many victims. What has changed, I think, however, in our society is the development of the culture of gambling, where it's become not only part of entertainment, but now it's used by governments and others as a source of significant fundraising rather than by way of taxation. And we've changed the terminology from gambling to gaming to make it more palatable. And in the process, we have found that many Catholic institutions even have decided, well, we're going to go along with this because this is easy money for us. And we are now starting to look at the morality from the vantage point of a Catholic institution getting involved in the raising of money through an industry that is morally problematic insofar as it's based on greed and it takes advantage of the weak and the vulnerable in our society.
Bishop Henry has been spearheading a campaign to try to persuade Catholic schools to put an end to the use of casino and bingo fundraising ventures.
The major concerns that we have at this time are government-sponsored, what we call charity casinos, in which the individual schools or societies associated with the schools agree to provide workers who will assist in the actual holding of gambling events through the staffing of the venues and the running of the various games and so on. And this is wherein we have now a proliferation of this, and the individual schools, of course, receive a certain percentage or a certain cut from the revenues that come. So it looks like a win-win all around. The industry itself gets more support. The individual charity needs, whether it's a school or something else, can easily plug into this. And through the working of one or two nights, you can raise $60,000 or more. And one of the things that, of course, has happened is that we see an increasing dependence or reliance upon gambling because it's much easier than trying to raise money in other forms, such as bake sales or individual selling of individual products. But now I think we're moving into a situation where we're really gambling with our kids' futures and we're setting a bad example for them. And this is now becoming a family policy issue and therefore a significant moral issue.
But how much money is being bet by gamblers? As Bishop Henry explains, it's often an eye-opener to learn just how much each household can spend on gambling.
When you look at an individual household, what it might mean in the life of a Canadian family is it's interesting to see on a comparative basis where the expenditures are made. So what they have determined, and this is not my figures, but comes from the Vanier Institute of the Family, actual gambling expenditures right now in Canada per household is $1,080. And that is higher than the amount that is spent on education, which is $1,007, and on personal care, which is $834. And it's very close to $1,588 that's spent on health care. So when you just look at the money that is going out and into this particular industry, we have to ask the question, well, what does this redirection of money mean for a family? And I'm afraid that many times not only are certain essentials kind of being overlooked by reason of the promise of perhaps, but many individuals are being affected. And we're not only dealing with the problem gamblers, but we're finding now that we're cannibalizing our local economies or redirecting discretionary spending away from established businesses, traditional charities, alternate forms of entertainment, and contrary to basic needs and support of family life itself.
Gambling is a money spinner for those providing it, and many governments have been quick to capitalize on the revenue that can be generated by the gambling industry. But in Bishop Henry's view, the Canadian government and others should not be seduced by this desire to swell their coffers with the proceeds from gambling profits. And that message, he says, goes for the Catholic Church as well.
I think one of the things that our governments have to do is get out of gambling business. They cannot be the regulator and the promoter and the beneficiary at one and the same time. For the Catholics involved, I think we have to once again emphasize the harm that this is doing to people. And once we begin to kind of put a face and a name to some of the devastating consequences of this and not just regard people as statistics.
Bishop Henry says it's precisely this conflict of interest that is so dangerous.
The gambling industry, including the government, has to promote its product in order to maximize its revenues. And one of the things that they're constantly doing is trying to sanitize the fallout. So, for example, in Canada, it was reported that there were 22 suicides, or when you consider the whole industry in Canada, that can be directly related to gambling. Well, you have a government that's involved in this, and the government is supposed to be protecting people. And yet, at the same time, the government is promoting gambling. And what is an acceptable level of suicide? Is it 22? Is it 50? Is it 1? We're simply not being realistic in terms of understanding that what we are doing to families and people is we're turning them once again into objects. We're trying to recruit new players. We're broadening the base of charitable workers. We're generating more use among existing players. The whole thing is based on greed, and it's exploitive.
That was Bishop Henry of Calgary in Canada, and earlier you heard John Farrelly, a Catholic counsellor in Ireland. I'm Susie Hodges. Families of murder victims and also the criminal who's facing the death penalty. Those are the twin activities of the Cherished Life Circle, a group in the US founded by the Sisters of Mercy to advocate for the abolition of capital punishment. The circle's primary goal is to campaign for the abolition of the death penalty through civil discourse and programs that uphold the sacredness of all life. One of its key activities is the annual holding of an ecumenical candlelight prayer service for the families of murder victims. Other activities include corresponding with people awaiting execution on death row, and also sometimes acting as a spiritual advisor to one or more of those prisoners. The Cherished Life Circle believes that no matter how horrendous the crime convicted, the perpetrator is a human being capable of repentance and turning over a new leaf. The circle was founded in 1993 by Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy based in New York City, together with other religious sisters from the order. She told me more about their aims and activities.
I formed the Cherished Life Circle in 1993 when Governor Mario Cuomo, who was an ardent advocate of the abolition of the death penalty, was going out of office, and the then Governor Pataki was coming into office hoping to restore the death penalty to New York State. We did not have it at that time in our state. I had in my circle of friends, religious, lay, and priests, people who have come together to discuss the significant issues of our times, war and peace, poverty. And when we looked at this, we said, what are we going to do to enter this dialogue and to try to prevent what the incoming governor hopes to bring? So we came together, as we do, educated people who pray, who speak, who write, who have educational platforms, and we began to promote that. Now, one of the things that we did at that time was we circulated a document which has been signed by people in Rome as well as other parts of the world. It is called a Declaration of Life. And that document says in its essence that I, the signer, whoever that signer is so opposed to the death penalty that were I to be murdered, I would not want my killer executed. That gives people an opportunity to speak very strongly for themselves without condemning people who entertain different views.
Now, I know that one of the things you do is organize an annual candlelit ecumenical service for people who have suffered the loss of their loved ones through murder. Can you tell us very briefly something about that?
Yes, I will tell you first, though, as a founder of the Cherished Life Circle, through circumstances not of my choosing, but now of my great appreciation, I am a spiritual advisor to a man on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana, David Paul Hammer. So I know very well the suffering of those who are awaiting execution. Some years ago, I would say 10 years ago now, we began to reach out to those relatives and friends of people who had been murdered. So we work with another group called Safe Horizon, which helps people who have suffered abuse. And every year at our Convent of Mercy in Brooklyn, a beautiful chapel that's been there since 1894, we have a service which invites people who have so suffered. And about 100 people will come. We as a Cherished Life Circle spend some time during the social and refreshment hour before listening to them, comforting them, giving them a chance to speak of their own pain. And then we move into the chapel where we have a lovely service. It is not a Catholic service because most of the people who come to us in the New York area are people of color, many from the Protestant tradition. So it's an ecumenical service. It's candlelight. Names are called. People are remembered. And very often we have a speaker, briefly, who has suffered the murder of a loved one, too. It is a very wonderful thing that we do. And now other groups are beginning to copy this, and we're happy about that.
It must be a very emotional and moving thing. I mean, presumably a lot of people must choke up, you know, at this service. What's it like?
Yes, we had a woman come as an observer for the first time. Now, she didn't have anyone die in her own family, but she was looking to plan a similar service in her parish. And I watched this woman, Dr. Clara Garrett, sitting there listening to the stories of these heartbroken people, and tears just wet her face. So yes, now, and I won't say that we're hardened to it, but we are used to this. We've seen it now 10 times, and it is comforting. One of the surprising things about these services, while we have had these 10 years, only once have we had anyone call for the death penalty for the person who murdered his son. Now, I think that's extraordinary. It is much more common for us to see these wounded, faith-filled people say, "I don't want another mother to suffer the pain I have endured." So they want punishment, but not execution.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you are spiritual advisor to a man on death row called David Hammer. Can you briefly sketch for us the reason that he ended up on death row and how long he's been there?
David Paul Hammer is 49 years old, and he has been continually incarcerated since he was 19. He grew up in poverty in the state of Oklahoma with parents who were migrant workers and a mother who was abusive. They moved around a great deal so that his education was never complete. It was a different school every few months. By the time he was 16 and the victim of psychological, physical, sexual abuse, he ran away, got into drugs, married at 16, fathered a child, and at 19, was involved in armed robbery. He had been before the judge a number of times, and in, I guess, exasperation, the judge then sentenced him to 1,200 years, no possibility of parole. Now, at 19, when he heard the doors slam behind him, he had no reason to accommodate the system, whereas no social system had served him well. So he continued to do, you know, negative things in prison, and in 1996, he murdered a cellmate, for which he got the death penalty. But in the meantime, he underwent a conversion and has become, well, they call him at Terre Haute the unofficial chaplain. He is so good with the other inmates. He's brilliant, and he's a paralegal. He takes care of their appeals. He looks out for their special needs. No one on death row has money, and most of them are there because of poor counsel. He helps them in 100 ways. He also designs Christmas cards, which we sell every year. And for the past 7 years, we have probably contributed over $50,000 or $60,000 to help children in need, mostly in agencies responsibly handled by religious institutions. David was confirmed a Catholic, brought into the faith in his cell in Terre Haute, Indiana, in October of 2000. He has passed 3 execution dates, and most recently his death sentence has been vacated because of information that went to the nature of the killing. It was not premeditated, it was accidental. But he remains on death row because the government is appealing that.
Now, you said he had a very abusive childhood, particularly his mother. There was one incident there that you told me about earlier that involved a puppy, right?
Mm-hmm. When David was about 10 years old, he had a younger brother, slightly retarded, and a still younger sister, probably about 6 years old. Someone took compassion on these really poor children, hungry, very often hungry children, not cared for, and clearly being abused, and they gave the family a puppy. Now, anyone who has ever owned a dog knows how quickly the bonding occurs. And so it was that in the course of the day, the 3 children played with the dog. They owned it. They loved it. And when the mother came home, she went into one of her irrational fits. She sent David up to the house, the shack, to get a burlap bag, and she sent the two younger children away. Then she forced David to watch her while she clubbed the puppy to death. He screamed in protest, screamed and cried, and to no avail. And when the puppy was dead, she forced David to drag the burlap bag to the nearby pond and throw it in. It was kind of interesting that the last day that David was supposed to be executed, his execution date was set. It was about 48 hours before the execution. He was told that the execution wouldn't take place. I was with him the day the execution was to take place. That was June 8th, 2004. We were together in a prison cell. And at the end of the time, we prayed together. But that night he called a friend in Indianapolis, and he said, "I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go to the dog pound, and I want you to rescue a dog that is slated to be executed, slated for death, an unwanted animal." He said, "I can't save another human being, but perhaps I can save a dog." And so the woman he called went, and she got the dog, and David calls that his dog, which was trained to visit elderly people in the nursing homes. And so that dog lives because David lives. But I'm sure there's a connection with that childhood memory.
Okay, coming back to the families of murder victims, have you got any feedback from those who you have helped or any other poignant anecdotes to share with us?
Oh, there are so many. There is one woman whose son was murdered 14 years ago. Her name is Vida Ibrahim, and she has come to every service. She loves them. She says it's the only place where she really feels that people understand and she's at home. One of the first services, it might have been the very first one we had, we pre-register everybody. We make out signs that bear the names of the murdered person, and the family member representing the murdered person wears that sign in the chapel during the service. Well, just as the service was about to begin, I could hear someone running up the steps, and there was a young boy all dressed in suit and tie and brown shoes. It's a small African-American child, and I said, "Honey, what are you doing here?" And he said, "My mama sent me." I said, "But do you know what this is?" And he said, "Yes, my mama only heard today that it's for people who were murdered. My brother was murdered." "How old was he?" "He was 15. My mama's sick. She couldn't come, so she sent me." "How did you get here?" "I took two trains." The boy was 10 years old. So, you know, we quickly made a sign and added his brother's name to the list. And we seated him with some of the mothers in the chapel. And when his brother's name was called and he stood to go to the center aisle, to go into the sanctuary with his lighted candle, which was part of the ritual, he burst out crying. His little shoulders shook, and mothers surrounded him and brought him up, you know, to the sanctuary. And it was a very moving moment. And then when the service was over, I looked for that child. I needed more information about him, but he was gone. He wasn't where the refreshments were. He wasn't out on the street. But that boy in the brown shoes remains in my mind almost 10 years now as kind of the angel that alerts us to the fact that children should not see that violence has the last word, and that faith can help individuals to overcome the worst hardships, and that there is a community of support.
So you never found out where he came from or anything more?
No,
about him?
Nothing.
I was speaking there to Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy from New York City.
That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. Laudato Jesus Christus.